Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, one of the most common concerns doctors hear from their patients is related to digestive health. Many people are looking for ways to prevent things like bloating or gas or indigestion. And our guest says a lot of those issues could be reduced by making changes to our diets. So we'll be talking about your gut and gut health in just a few minutes. But right now, as we know, coronavirus has changed pretty much everything. And I think one of the best things we can do while maintaining physical distance is to show some social connection on behalf of each other and our communities. And Wisconsin Public Radio is celebrating our community partners in part by participating in what's called Giving Tuesday. WPR Director Mike Crane with us right now by phone. Mike, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Larry. And this is a special day. In fact, they added a word. They're calling it Giving Tuesday now. And that's because this is a special day all over the globe to support organizations that make a difference in our communities. And it's in addition to the traditional Giving Tuesday we all remember from around the holiday times in November, December. And the idea is that we get through these difficult times together, and that one of the things we do is we learn on the radio from WPR.org what's going on in our communities, staying connected this way, and learning about what's going on with those first responders, the service providers, the healthcare workers, and all the organizations that we all work with.
It's such an uncertain time, and I know, and I can tell from the callers that we have, that people are looking for ways to engage. And for those who can, many people will want to financially support organizations that they're finding help from and support from. And I think WPR is one of those organizations vital to our community.
Absolutely right. And I know that I'm participating by having sent an email to a lot of our supporters today. And my email box, and I'm sure many people's email boxes, is filling up. And I want to encourage people to support those organizations they value, not just WPR, but of course, here we are on WPR, and we invite you to get in touch. You can do that support on WPR.org, or of course, we always have the phone number as well, and that's 888-202-2552.
And we've made some significant changes, I think, in reducing our fundraising efforts. We stopped our door-to-door canvassing, I'm pretty sure, didn't we?
We did, and that has been an effective way for us to find new members, just like our regular member drives are. But obviously, in this time, people wouldn't be answering the door in all likelihood, and we wanted to keep our canvassers and our potential supporters and current supporters safe. And so that's one of the things that's changed, Larry. Another is that, and this won't surprise anyone, with many businesses impacted or even closed during our Safer at Home order, one of the things we're seeing is a reduction in our business sponsorship revenue, and we kind of expect that to continue as things slowly open, but maybe even some businesses don't. And what that means is we count on philanthropic support more, and that includes people that listen to The Larry Mueller Show and the rest of WPR.
Yeah, and of course, it's an easy thing to do right now. You can support us online right now. Go to WPR.org, or you can phone the number, again, Mike mentioned it, 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552. Certainly, we encourage you to engage now with your support.
And one of the things, Larry, is that, I think like everybody else, we've all made adjustments. I certainly don't mean to say that any of the adjustments we've made are unique. Just so proud of our friends and neighbors throughout Wisconsin and how they're helping each other to be safe during this time, to be fed. There's all kinds of things that people are doing. And part of what we thought about as we headed into that time, I've come to think of it as bugging out, where many of us left our studios in order to broadcast from home like I'm doing at the moment and others as well, and to do most of our work in a new way. I know that's what everyone is doing. And we think our part is to continue the conversations, to provide you the coronavirus news and related stories on our website, WPR.org/COVID, and also to invite you to ask the questions you have. We've had a lot of great questions from folks using our Wisconsin project. And if you go to that page, WPR.org/COVID, you'll find that opportunity to ask questions that you have. And that's all supported by the people that listen and use our website.
Well, Mike, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I just want to remind everybody, once again, you can support us online at WPR.org. Just go there. Or you can phone, and the number's 888-202-2552. Always a pleasure, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. And we'll give a listen now to clearing up our guts.
Okay, that's right. And who better to help us with that than Melissa Phillips? She is a master's trained dietitian for the UW Health Digestive Health Center. Prior to that, she started and built from the ground up the GI nutrition program at Dean Health Gastroenterology. So we're talking all about digestive problems and diet today. A little later on, we'll talk and more specifically about athletes and digestive issues. But right now we can talk about probiotics. We can talk about fiber, gluten, and how you can improve your digestive health with Melissa Phillips. Have you made any changes to your diet that have improved your digestive health? You have some problems you'd like to ask our dietitian about? I know it's always hard to talk about them sometimes, but yeah, you know, it's over the air. Nobody's looking at you. They can just hear you. We certainly welcome your questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. And Melissa Phillips with us by phone. Melissa, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me today.
Maybe talk a bit more about your background before we get started. You had a lot of experience with gastroenterology, including creating an entire program for a healthcare organization.
Yeah, so back in 2010, we found a need for having a specific dietitian designated to gastroenterology because there were so many patients coming through their clinic that we weren't able to help at a general nutrition level. So I was asked to step into that role and really create a program and material and things for patients to take home with them after seeing me that could help them continue to see improvement in their digestive health. So that is a program where I'm proud of being able to build that program and then to transfer that knowledge over to UW Health.
Yeah. What are some common reasons why a patient might come to see you related to digestive issues?
Well, a lot of our patients that we see at UW are fairly complex. A lot of IBD, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, newly diagnosed celiac disease, but irritable bowel syndrome is probably the diagnosis that takes over most of what we see. It's a very common diagnosis. It's an umbrella diagnosis, if you will, when we really can't figure out an organic reason or process for what's going on with the patient.
So how do you, it sounds like then it's difficult to sort of diagnose, then how do you go about treating?
Yeah, so for many, many years, we used to tell patients with irritable bowel syndrome that it was stress-related, it was maybe all in their head, and then not me specifically, but maybe their providers, and that they needed to reduce their stress or maybe start exercising a little more. But then they started to find a link between diet and irritable bowel syndrome over in the Monash University in Australia. They started some trials there and found that certainly specific sugars that we reference as FODMAP can certainly affect people in certain ways, can affect them negatively. And we started bringing that diet over to the United States and really educating people, figuring out what works, doesn't work. And then, here we are.
Well, here we are. And you mentioned diet and talking about it. And Susan in Madison has a comment relating to it, I believe. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had in late September, I ended up in the hospital for 9 days. I thought I was a very healthy 63-year-old. I had a blowout of one of those pockets in your intestine, that you get pockets when you have too much pressure through your intestinal system as food passes through your body and out. And I was, the entire time I was there, I was very sick. I was told that I was not out of the woods regarding having to have a considerable surgery.
You sound pretty good now.
I'm feeling amazingly well, and I wanted to get across something. I've had a wonderful experience finding out that I should have been having 25 grams of fiber a day and a lot of water, and I wasn't doing either of those. I just didn't pay attention because I was strong and healthy. But then when I looked back, this is the important part that I care deeply about. When I looked back at my 5-year-ago colonoscopy, it said on there, yay, you're cancer-free. And then down below there, it said that I had, what is that illness called? What, it's an itis? I've already forgot what it is.
Diverticulitis. Diverticulitis?
That is correct. That mm-hmm. is correct. And that's what I had. I feel that because I'm a thinking person, if I had been talked to by the doctors or someone, when they told me you have diverticulitis in a one line on a piece of paper that came to me in the mail, I didn't even see it.
Yeah.
I wish I would have opened that letter and I would have seen a bright fluorescent colored note saying, here's what you've got. Here's what you should do if you want to stay healthy. Please do it.
Yeah. Well, I want to break in and give thanks for calling, Susan, by the way. Melissa, I'm sure you have some comments relating to Susan's story.
Absolutely. So diverticulosis is the condition that she was talking about, where we have these outpouchings in the large intestine that occur if there's a lot of pressure, like she said, placed on the muscle. It's very common in people over 50. Constipated folks tend to be a little bit more prone to diverticulosis. And then diverticulitis occurs when something, and usually it's fecal matter, gets caught in that pocket, and then we get the itis or the diverticulitis she was talking about. And most people can get through a diverticulitis episode without a hospitalization. It's usually an antibiotic, but she's not wrong about, had she known what to do after the colonoscopy, it could have been prevented. We don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict the future, but she's right. Plenty of water, liquid, 25 grams of fiber a day, soluble fiber may have prevented the itis from occurring.
Yeah. Melissa Phillips, our guest, you can join in too with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Chris and Adams called to say that this attention to gut health, Chris feels, is especially important in this time of COVID-19. Would you agree?
Yeah, there's studies coming out every day that there's a lot of gut-related symptoms that are occurring. In the beginning, we felt that there wasn't. It was all respiratory related, but especially in kiddos, they're finding that there are some GI symptoms that mimic that Kawasaki syndrome. So it is something to be mindful of. The gut lining can become inflamed, especially in the younger population.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we can take some more calls. Just a reminder, we're talking today about digestive health, diet, and nutrition with our guest, Melissa Phillips. I'm Larry Mueller. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you're listening to the Ideas Network. taking a look at your digestive health today, diet and nutrition with our guest, Melissa Phillips, master's trained dietitian for UW Health Digestive Health Center. Great to have her along. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas at WPR.org. Melissa, how do we differentiate between normal, occasional digestive problems and the kind of more frequent problems that would be a cause of, you know, to change something up that we're doing or maybe to seek a doctor's advice?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I think it's very normal on occasion to have some digestive difficulties, to have a little bit of gas, a loose stool, maybe go a couple days without a bowel movement. But when things are happening more consistently, you know, 3 to 4 times a week, for example, somebody's complaining of a lot of gas pain, cramping, or they're having multiple loose stools a day, many days a week, that's when we would really recommend that they seek the care of a trained physician, primary care provider to start with, and then one of our GI providers.
Greg in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hello, Greg. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I'm wondering if the political and economic influence of the meat and dairy industry has what effect the meat and dairy industry has on the health, digestive health and cardiovascular health, heart health of a society of the world. When for thousands of years we have, as human beings, lived on hunting and gathering of seeds, plants, and how this has changed in the industrial age when you're taught at a young age with the four basic food groups and the food pyramid that meat and dairy are so important in the diet. I'm curious how this affects the human health.
Okay, well, let's turn to Melissa. What do you think, Melissa?
Sure. Well, you know, meat and dairy certainly have a place in the diet, and we don't dissuade people from consuming those things at all. Dairy products have a great, form of protein, calcium, vitamin D. Some of them have probiotics, natural probiotics in them, but we have definitely ramped up our meat intake. And I know there's a lot of movement towards meatless meals these days, which is good. The plant-based diet is very helpful to the gut microbiome. So I guess in regards to that question, I would say making sure that there's a place for everything in the diet, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, those are all very important to building a good gut microbiome. Where meat doesn't do that. It doesn't have that property to it. And then again, with the dairy, usually just the fermented dairy products. So everything has a place. It's that old adage, moderation.
Can digestive issues cause or correlate with other health problems? I don't know, stress or headaches, maybe fatigue, things like that.
Absolutely. Celiac disease is one of those autoimmune disease GI diagnoses that some people are diagnosed because they're fatigued or tired or because they have a lot of joint pain. We'll start to run some of those laboratory tests and find that they have something like celiac disease. But stress and irritable bowel syndrome certainly go hand in hand. A lot of people will notice their symptoms ramp up if they are particularly stressed.
How many of these problems you see in patients can be resolved by diet or changing your diet?
That's a good question. I would say that certainly at least half of our patients do notice some improvement in their symptoms with changes in diet, maybe even more than that. I'm just kind of arbitrarily pulling out a number, but most of our folks do respond to the changes that we recommend. And those that don't, there may be something else going on that we really haven't figured out yet. So we will refer them back to the provider for a little bit more investigation to see what's happening. But we always try diet, certainly. There's always something that we can do to help improve our digestive health through diet.
And I'm guessing that it may not be just a general one-size-fits-all kind of diet change.
Correct. And that's the role of the dietitian, is to really take assessment of what's going on with the patient, really to listen to what they have to say, what's going on in regards to their symptoms, how often are the symptoms occurring, and in what scenarios are they occurring. And if there's, you know, some things that we can do easily, increase fiber to help with constipation, we're going to go for that versus maybe putting them on some sort of really restrictive elimination diet.
Yeah. You've been doing this for a while now. Are you seeing an increased number of digestive issues in people, or maybe they're more willing to talk about it?
I think it's the latter. People are definitely more willing to discuss it. It's less of a taboo issue. And a lot of people feel embarrassed when they come in our office when we start to ask pretty personal questions like how many bowel movements, what does it look like, what's the color. But most of our patients, after we sort of get that rapport built with them, are perfectly comfortable with answering those questions. And I think it's just a sign of the times. People want to feel better and they don't mind, you know, telling us what's going on.
Yeah. And well, you know, Greg was kind of getting at changes in the diet. Do the issues have a lot to do with how our mainstream diets have changed over the last century or so?
Absolutely. With the increase in very overprocessed packaged foods that maybe have little or no nutritional value to them, what we're noticing is the gut microbiome, or I always call it the gut neighborhood, starts to dwindle a little bit because those processed packaged items contain a lot of sugar. They may contain a lot of fat. And so our diversity starts to decrease in our microbiome. And when the diversity decreases, we start to notice an increase in symptoms, which can lead to things like, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. They are finding a link between the microbiome and those chronic health conditions. So, yeah, that's definitely a topic of conversation we have with a lot of our folks.
I was just thinking about my own situation here this afternoon, probably sometime late in the day. I'm going to make another batch of sourdough bread because I spend a lot of time at home these days. And I'm wondering if more people are spending time at home doing more cooking and maybe using a little less of the processed foods.
Absolutely. We're currently working from home as well. And one thing we have noticed, I've noticed at least consistently when talking to patients over the phone, is that they are feeling a lot better despite even the recommendations we've made, because they aren't eating out as much. They're not, you know, grabbing a cupcake at the office break room. They're eating the fruits and vegetables they're buying and not letting them go bad. They're baking, they're making sourdough bread, which is one of the, you know, more easily digested types of bread out there. So we are seeing an improvement with this pandemic and people kind of bringing it back to the kitchen, which is great.
Let's take another call. David in Hudson, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling, David. What's on your mind?
Hey, I wanted to ask your guest about the long-term gut implications or biome implications of using products like omeprazole. I've had problems my whole life, particularly digesting red meat and dairy stuff and sugars, and just wondering what the implications are long-term use. I do get some relief from that, but quite often, you know, it's a almost daily problem. So just wondering what the long-term use of those things. I see them at, you know, big box stores, and sometimes it's sold out. So I know a lot of people are using it. So I'm curious.
Okay. Melissa, what do you think?
Yeah, and I know that's kind of, we're on the cusp of that research right now in determining whether the proton pump inhibitors can affect the microbiome negatively. But on the other hand of things, I always say, why are we taking the proton pump inhibitor? Is it because somebody has severe reflux and they could end up with, let's say, esophageal cancer because they're not treating that? I think I would rather have that patient not get esophageal cancer and maybe deal on the other end of things with the gut microbiome by increasing the diversity of our diet and making sure that that patient is eating lots of plant-based items, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. So I don't have a great answer for that. I know, again, it's in sort of the, we're on the cusp of the data and the research for that to really prove whether or not the PPIs are impacting the gut microbiota negatively.
Interesting. Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Judy emailed to say, and here she cured her own irritable bowel syndrome by taking diet soda out of her diet. Can something as simple as that really work?
It can. I've had a couple of folks along the way where that's the only thing we did. Some of those artificial sweeteners can have a negative impact on the gut microbiota. So if we do take them out, we take that out of the equation, the patient may notice an improvement. But a lot of soda has caffeine, and caffeine can be a gastric stimulant. So if there was a loose stool associated with it, it may have improved by just cutting the caffeine out too. So maybe a twofold.
Wayne in Rockford emailed, he has a routine that he's been doing for a long time, works for him. He takes a Lyme probiotic at bedtime and after lunch. At noon, he has yogurt, a couple teaspoons of flaxseed meal. He also drinks 80 ounces of water a day and never skips a day.
Great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, probiotics right now, so taking tablet, capsule, however the format is. The data behind those right now is limited. It's honestly something that we don't generally recommend in clinic because they are expensive and there's maybe a small chance that they'll work, but not 100%. But if he's finding that they work for him, I would not have him discontinue that regimen at this time.
Yeah. What is it about probiotics? What is something like, I guess yogurt is a probiotic.
Yeah, yogurt contains live active cultures, which are our natural probiotics. And some of them will make it to the large intestine, some of those bacteria, but some of them will be killed off by stomach acid. Some of them will just not make it through the small intestine intact. So we can't rely 100% on food necessarily to provide good probiotics. The best way to build up our microbiome is by taking in prebiotics, and prebiotics are found in just about every fruits and vegetable and whole grain out there. So that's how we build a good gut microbiome, is diet diversity. And I always preach that, diet diversity.
Well, that it makes a lot of sense. And if you, in your mind, what is a good breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What would it contain?
Wow, that's a good question. a good breakfast might include some sort of whole grain. So let's say we did some oats or oatmeal, but also included some sort of protein with that, whether it's, a couple of eggs, maybe a spoonful of peanut butter. But I'd always add something else fibrous to that, like the flax meal or flaxseed or chia seed. And then some sort of fruit for breakfast would be good. Again, more good prebiotics. Lunch, I know a lot of people are into doing meal prep, so it could include a small 3-ounce piece of chicken, fish, with a nice healthy side of vegetables, maybe some fruit, and a little bit of a whole grain like quinoa, rice alongside it. And then for dinner, maybe something very similar. And then snacks, again, I'm always going to advocate for nuts, fruits, vegetables, avocado, anything that kind of fits in that Mediterranean style diet.
I love pistachios.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about pistachios?
Oh, yes. Pistachios are great. They're a good source of fiber, lots of vitamins, minerals, zinc, B vitamins, those types of things. So good. They're a good nut. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Krista emailed with a question. She says that she's had issues with constipation since she was 5 years old. She's tried everything under the sun. And she's tired of doctors telling her to drink more water and eat more fiber. She's healthy in every other way. She gets regular, moderate exercise. She wonders if it's a sign of a deficiency that she could supplement in some way, or an intolerance of some sort.
If there are other accompanying symptoms to the constipation, let's say gas, bloating, cramping, it could be certainly an intolerance. I mentioned the FODMAP diet earlier. It could be that. But especially when people have been dealing with constipation lifelong, it can be things like just very slow transit constipation. It's just the way that person's body works. Sometimes the colon is what we would call tortuous, or it has a few turns and twists that a normal colon doesn't have. So from a physiological standpoint, the content just isn't moving through like it's supposed to. And then with women, a lot of times, too, what we'll see is their pelvic floors can be really tight. And I can't speak a lot to pelvic floor physical therapy, but I do see a lot of patients who deal with constipation. And if they see a pelvic floor physical therapist and they work their magic, a lot of times the constipation improves. So I would revisit the doctor, primary care provider, GI provider, and see if she could get that referral to maybe a pelvic floor physical therapist.
Yeah. Good advice. Krista in Milwaukee emailed, her GI doc tells her that she has a hiatal hernia, and it's what's causing her pain when she swallows, as well as some random vomiting. What kinds of food or how prepared are good to avoid these problems? She's seen no correlation with any food or spice or preparation method other than when she overeats, of course, it's more likely to happen.
Right. So no specific diet for a hiatal hernia, but the small, frequent meals can be really helpful, and consuming liquids outside of the meal. So maybe not, drinking a whole 8-ounce glass of water at the same time as your meal, but sipping on it throughout the day could be helpful. Anything that will allow things to empty out of the stomach more quickly versus filling it up so fast that a hiatal hernia affects it negatively.
What is a hiatal hernia? Somebody else wondered, and I'm not sure what it is myself.
it's kind of where some of the stomach sort of pops up through that hole where the esophagus goes through in the diaphragm. So some of the stomach is above the diaphragm and then some of it's below. A small hiatal hernia might just be a little blep of it, but a larger one could be half the stomach. So, it can be very uncomfortable.
Yeah,
they can fix them if they get really bad, but certainly that's up to the provider's discretion.
Sandy from McGuanago emailed a question. She has she was on clindamycin for 17 days, and during the time she took a probiotic between clindamycin doses, this helped stave off diarrhea. Would it be beneficial to continue probiotic daily after ending the antibiotic? And if so, for how long?
That's a great question. I always say this, it's probably not going to hurt to continue it. And, with any antibiotic, it can take up to a year for the gut microbiome to sort of reestablish itself. So if she was going to continue, I would say go ahead if you want to. It may or may not help, but it may take about a year. So, especially if the probiotic is fairly inexpensive, I may have her continue with it.
Yeah, well, it's not going to hurt.
Right. It likely won't hurt. There's back in September, we were at a conference in Michigan, and they did find some critical care patients in ICUs that had been on probiotics that had become septic. So there is some risk associated with probiotics. Now, these were very isolated cases, but I think it's just something that we're really going to have to keep our eyes on and maybe change our tune instead of saying, well, it won't hurt. Been saying things like that, it could hurt, so you have to be kind of careful. But in her case, it's probably okay. So.
Oh, man. Are there some sort of food intolerances that create problems? I mean, there are different food allergies from what I understand. And are those something you would talk about with a patient?
So food allergies are generally diagnosed in younger, the pediatric population. And so we don't generally touch on food allergies. We have a pediatric dietitian who specializes in food allergies. And generally, adults don't develop food allergies. Adults can have sensitivities to foods. Now, there's no testing for that. There's no biomarker for that. And if anybody sees anything out there for food sensitivity testing, it's complete bunk, so don't buy it. there's no science behind it at all. Sounds good, though. So just say, I always tell patients, you may be sensitive to something, but there's no way I can prove it. So if you feel like it causes symptoms when you eat, let's say a strawberry, then just avoid the strawberries. But the time we spend mostly with our patients with IBS is discussing something called a low FODMAP diet, which has a lot of intricacies and detail, so I won't go into that today. But FODMAPs and irritable bowel syndrome tend to go hand in hand.
Hmm. Renee and Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Renee.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Three weeks ago, I went to the emergency room with a gallbladder attack and ended up in the hospital for 4 days, had my gallbladder removed, and then was treated for acute pancreatitis. I had gallstones blocking the bile duct.
Hmm.
So that was 3 weeks ago. I'm feeling really good now. Starting to eat more normally. and I know I should be on a low-fat, high-fiber diet now, is what they recommend. But I guess I don't know a lot about pancreatitis and what I should be, going forward now.
In terms of eating, sure.
For.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Melissa?
Yeah. So acute pancreatitis, it can happen with these gallbladder issues. And generally speaking, we do, for a time after somebody's had an acute pancreatitis episode, consume that low-fat diet like you were mentioning before, just so that we don't make that pancreas angry again, because it was angry for a while. It didn't want to secrete enzymes. It didn't want to help out and do its job. So we want to kind of keep it calm for a little while. And reducing the fat in the diet is a good way to do that. And then after, you said 3 weeks ago, after a couple of months or so, certainly start to increase the fat, good fats, not, greasy cheeseburgers. I'm thinking like avocado, that would be great, or nuts. And start to see how you feel. If you're doing okay, you can start to gradually increase those as the days go on and sort of find a new normal for you in terms of the cholecystectomy or the removal of the gallbladder, as well as the acute pancreatitis. And the hope is that pancreatitis doesn't come back. Again, we have no crystal ball. We can't predict it. But the hope is that it was just isolated with this gallbladder removal and that it doesn't return.
Melissa, do you have a sort of a general guide for us or comment in terms of our own diet? Want to, sort of day in, day out to help eliminate some of these issues?
Yeah. Again, I'm going to preach that diet diversity. So the more varied diet you can get, the better. Good sleep or rest really helps with gut microbiome. Exercise and activity, it helps with gut microbiome, and then stress reduction. So those are sort of your four pillars of really good digestion.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Melissa. I hope we have a chance to visit again when you come back and be with us again.
I would love to. I would love to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Melissa Phillips, a master's trained dietitian. She's worked at UW Health Digestive Health Center for 4 years. Prior to that, she started and built from the ground up the GI nutrition program at Dean Clinic in Madison. So it's great to have her with us today. And you know what? We're going to continue with a look at our gut and diet, because coming up next, we have the author of a book titled The Athlete's Gut, The Inside Science of Digestion, Nutrition, and Stomach Distress. That coming up next with our guest, Patrick Wilson. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.